This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Well, good evening. I'm Steve Snyder. I'm the CEO here at the Reuben H. Fleet Science Center. And on behalf of the trustees, the staff, and our volunteers, I'd like to welcome you here tonight. We're very excited to have you here and our speakers for this event. And hopefully you all got a chance to explore Genome, Unlocking Life's Code, in the gallery upstairs. We're very excited to have this exhibition. We are the West Coast premiere, and in fact, this is the first site outside of the Smithsonian for this exhibit to be viewed. So you are the first publics to see this really remarkable exhibition on a very, very important topic. They're all gathered here to learn more about. The exhibit was developed by the Smithsonian Institution and the National Human Genome Research Institute at the National Institutes of Health, and I think they really did a spectacular job. It's very appropriate, I think, for the exhibit to have its both West Coast premiere and its non-DC premiere, if you put it that way, here in San Diego. You know, as most of you know, San Diego is an epicenter for genomics research. The very unique mix of what we have here in terms of academic research, independent institute research, corporate research, hospital research, practitioners, education that happens here really makes San Diego a very special place in this. We've had a huge role in where genomics has come, what's happening today, and will probably play a huge role in where it goes from here and the advancements and what it can do, the impact it can make on society. And it's something San Diego should be particularly proud of, I think, to have this kind of research here, to have this kind of effort here, to have this position in this very important field. At the same time, we can't really feel too terribly proud. And that's because despite the huge scientific resources we have here, the practitioner resources here, the education resources we have here, we are in many ways failing. Our California 8th graders aren't in the top 5 in science, or the top 10, or top 20, or 30, or 40, or 45, or 47th in the country when it comes to science. It's California, Alabama, and Mississippi, and we tie Alabama. So you think about this huge asset we have here, and all the research and science, the engineering that comes from this. And here we have our children, our future, those future researchers, and we are not preparing them to take part in our genomic future. Instead, we have this mindset where we'll go and we'll steal talent from elsewhere instead of developing the talent that's right here. And that's something we know we have to change. That's something we know we all have to be involved in. And that's the reason that the Fleet wanted to bring this exhibit here. Not just because it's important that people understand genomics, because it's absolutely true, but given the position of San Diego, given the power of San Diego to determine the future of this field, we have to engage everyone in this. We have to develop the talent that we have in this town, the potential of our kids to be able to take part in this and to make those next step advancements, to help develop that future by developing the future of our kids. And so that's the ulterior motive here tonight. Our ulterior motive of having an event like this here tonight is not just to inform you, but to hope that these speakers inspire you with what you hear about what's going on in the field so that you take that back out into your neighbors and communities and kids, whether it's independently or with a school or working here with the Fleet, to be able to get out there and make that change, to get our kids excited about the potential here, to really get them engaged in what this can be so that we can ensure that that next researcher who makes that transformative discovery, who makes that new application, that new practice, isn't something that we stole from somewhere else, but someone that was born, bred, educated, and raised right here in San Diego. That's our opportunity. And if we're going to do that, that has to start right now, and it has to start right here. So tonight we have a range of speakers here who will hopefully do that, hopefully inspire you, educate you, enlighten you about what's going on in the field of genomics, and hopefully you'll carry away with this idea of not just new information for yourself, but what we need to do with that information, with that talent we have here to develop that next generation of talent. Now, an event like this takes a lot of people to do a lot of things. And we have to have the opportunity now to thank some of the folks who financially made this possible. I'd like to thank Illumina, who was our corporate sponsor in helping with the reception that you received upstairs. They're also providing some grant support for the CME portion of tonight's program. Our trustees, Mark Bracker, Mike Kalichman, Bill Carley, who were the visionaries behind this to pull this event together and who also give financial support, and Dr. Carley also through Mindpiece Partners, his organization, Lifeline Healthcare, and the San Diego County Medical Society, all of whom were involved in making this tonight possible. So I'd like you to join me in thanking all of those folks for this evening. Now, to get this kicked off, I'd like to introduce tonight's moderator. Dr. Kelly Frazier is a professor and founding chief of the Division of Genomic Information Sciences, the Department of Pediatrics, director of UC San Diego's Institute of Genomic Medicine, and a leader in the university's Clinical and Translational Research Institute. Prior to joining UCSD, she was at Scripps Research Institute and also at Pearl Gen Sciences, and she'll be leading the discussion here tonight. She'll be moderating the discussion and also take your questions. So please help me welcome Dr. Frazier.
Good evening. It's my pleasure to be moderating tonight, and I'm just going to quickly introduce the three speakers that we have lined up here. We're going to be starting with Dr. Eric Green, who's the director of the National Human Genome Research Institute, the NHGRI. And Eric is a longtime friend and colleague of mine, so I'm very pleased that he was able to join us tonight. Dr. Green has been involved in the Human Genome Research Project since its inception and has been a longtime proponent of using genomic information for precision medicine. Next, we'll have Dr. Roselle Kruziak speak with us. She's a professor of medicine at UCSD and the director for the Center for Personalized Cancer Therapy in Clinical Trials Office. Dr. Kruziak is a pioneer in using genomic information for informing the treatment of cancer patients. So it will be very exciting to hear what she has to say. And then finally, we'll have Dr. Gary Feierstein present. He's a professor in the Department of Medicine at UCSD and the director of the Clinical and Translational Research Institute. Dr. Feierstein has been intimately involved in translating both genetic, and epigenetic discoveries into clinical utility. So he'll give us both the insights into the genetics as well as epigenetics. And I've been asked to make sure that everyone understands that we will be having a session at the end of our three speakers where there'll be a question and answers. Well, let's get started. Thank you, Dr. Eric Green.
Thank you, Kelly, and thanks to the Fleet Center for hosting this event this evening, and thanks to all of you for coming out. I'm delighted to really be participating in this. Now, I recognize this is probably a fairly heterogeneous audience. It's a continuing medical education program, so I know we have physicians, but I also know we have members of the general public and various other people that came to the program. And so recognizing that there is some heterogeneity, I just want to sort of start with some basics about the human genome. The human body consists of something like 10 trillion cells or so, and essentially every one of those cells is operating off the same blueprint. That blueprint lives in the middle of the cells in a structure called a nucleus, on structures called chromosomes, which are basically suitcases that carry our blueprint material from cell to cell. What we're really going to talk about today is this blueprint information, which is this thing called DNA. And DNA is this incredibly intriguing and complicated molecule, but it's one that through a number of studies that have taken place over the decades, we have really begun to figure out how it is that it encodes all the information necessary for life. The thing about the human genome is it basically consists of a total of about 3 billion letters, if you will. And these are chemical bases that make up DNA. The intrigue, of course, is how is it that amongst these 3 billion letters or so is not only all the information necessary for life, but is being used by each of these 10 trillion or so cells in slightly different ways, because clearly a brain cell uses its blueprint for doing brain things, muscle cells uses its blueprint for using for important muscle things, and yet it's all the same blueprint it's reading off of. Well, being 3 billion bases, eventually, through a bunch of tools that were developed by scientists, we got to the point where we could say we might be able to figure out what the order of these letters are in our blueprint. And it is a finite problem. It's just 3 billion. And this led to the birth, if you will, of this field of genomics, which is what the feature aspect of this exhibition is and what we're going to be talking about tonight. And I want to really emphasize, it's a young discipline. The genomics as a term really only came into scientific existence in 1987, a significant year for me. It's the year I graduated medical school, which made sense that throughout medical school, I never heard the word genomics because it actually wasn't coined until this inaugural issue of a new journal called Genomics came out in 1987. And it was in that inaugural issue that the lead editorial talked about this newly emerging discipline, if you will, of genome mapping and sequencing, and really had the term genomics adopted, associated with it, and defined it as you can read up there. And the reason why the term genomics came out in the late 1980s was because it was a culmination of planning activities and, in some extent, debate about the idea of launching a large international effort to actually read out the 3 billion letters of the human genome. This effort eventually did get off the ground in a very robust way and took place from 1990 to 2003. This was called the Human Genome Project. I was fortunate enough to participate in this effort literally on day one and wrote it out till the end. It was an audacious endeavor, unlike biomedical research as we had known it up until that point, because it involved big groups coming together, almost like the moonshot, where we're going to put a person on the moon. We were going to do everything we could through international collaborations, thousands of scientists, many research groups, and factory-like facilities to figure out the order of the 3 billion letters that make up the human genome. But we did it, and we, in fact, did it quicker than we thought we could, and it was an incredible success story. It also was just the start of everything you're going to hear about tonight. It was by no means the end of anything. And in fact, what's been remarkable about genomics in the 11 and a half years or so since the end of the Genome Project was all the different ways that genomics has now found its way as a scientific discipline into areas of incredible importance. A subset of those areas are shown here, and any one of these could be a topic for an entire program like we're having this evening. None of these are things that I'm going to necessarily talk about, but I don't do that out of a lack of respect. I think these are great areas. I'm going to emphasize applications of genomics of health and disease and medicine, as I think the speakers that follow me will as well. The reason in particular that I'm going to emphasize those topics is related to where I work. I work at the largest funder of biomedical research in the world, the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, and in particular, the specific institute that I've now been at for 20 years is the National Human Genome Research Institute, which was originally created by the U.S. Congress to lead the U.S.'s effort in the Human Genome Project, but now has a mission that's a bit broader where we feel the responsibility to figure out how to advance human health through genomics research. So what I want to tell you about is very much a painting of the landscape of what's going on in human genomics now, especially what's happened since the Human Genome Project, and in particular thinking about what we are doing to try to reach the mission of advancing human health through genomics research. And I think the speakers that follow me will extend on this in specific areas. About 5 years ago, I became director of the National Human Genome Research Institute, and I will tell you that I saw incredible opportunities really on the near horizon for beginning to use what we've learned about our blueprint for now changing how we practice medicine by using that information. And I would say a key aspect of what we now do at our institute is to foster the emergence of this new discipline of medicine, which I refer to as genomic medicine. Now, by genomic medicine, I mean an emerging medical discipline that involves using genomic information about an individual as part of their clinical care and also the other implications of that care. You will hear other phrases such as individualized medicine, personalized medicine, precision medicine. These are all largely synonymous. I tend to use the phrase genomic medicine because of the focus on genomics. And what it basically means is that every one of us has a slightly different blueprint, And yet so much of medicine up until now has been treating people rather generically, as if we all had the identical blueprint. We now have the capabilities, and will increasingly get the capabilities, to take care of patients based on their unique genomic makeup. And that, my friends, is what genomic medicine is all about. Now, this is not something simple that will flip a switch and boom, we're done. It wasn't just a matter of sequencing the genome. In fact, in many ways, this is going to be a long journey to be able to eventually attain this, with the starting line really being the Human Genome Project. Eventually, and I think that realization of genomic medicine is already starting to be seen, but full-blown realization, I'm sure, is probably 5, 10, 15, 20 years away. We know how to get there in general terms, and I'm going to describe for you some of the steps that are necessary to get us there, but I don't want to leave you with an impression that I know exactly how all this is going to play out. I think there are some uncertainties here. The thing I do know is that this is not going to be done by any one individual, one group, one city, one medical school, even one country. This kind of paradigm shift for the way we practice medicine is going to require the collective creativity, energies, and successes of many, many individuals. And in fact, I make the analogy to almost like a marathon, both in terms of the number of people that are involved, but also the fact that it's going to be a long, long journey, one that's going to have many twists and turns along the way. So how do you do this at a sort of a federal agency responsible for this field of science and supporting it in the United States? And when you have this goal of going from the base pairs of the Genome Project to the bedside of patients, or from the double helix, if you prefer the metaphor, to human health. And what I'll tell you is the way we have found it useful to do is to sort of think about what are the grand opportunities at any given moment in time, and then strategize about it, and then articulate a vision that sort of lays out the steps that are needed in the immediate near term. We did this through a publication that came out literally the day the Genome Project ended, back in 2003, published this in the famous journal Nature, that articulated the what's next in 2003. But in fact, the what's next was quickly accomplished over the next 5, 6, 7 years, and we found it was necessary in 2011 to publish an updated version of a strategic vision for what this might look like. And in fact, notice that the title of our vision in 2011 even incorporated in the title this notion of genomic medicine, really moving to the point of having genomics become part of medical care. So I thought it'd be useful with particular thinking about this vision that we articulated back in 2011 would be to really tell you some of the key things that have gone on over the last really 11 years, but in fact some of the more recent ones in particular, that is really helping us bring genomic medicine finally into focus. And I'm going to really tell you about sort of 5 of these steps, if you will, along this marathon en route to genomic medicine. So what was the first thing that needed to be done to start to get us closer to genomic medicine? And I really would tell you, it was really about understanding and interpreting the human genome sequence. Now, you may say, well, wait a second, isn't that what the Genome Project did? And not quite. In fact, what the Genome Project did was to deliver this. Actually, it delivered far more than this, only 0.0001% of the 3 billion letters. But this is sequence of the human genome. And what you can immediately see is that just because the Genome Project was able to order the G's, A's, T's, and C's, 3 billion of them, it didn't mean it instantly became a simple read. And in fact, staring at sequence, if you don't do it on a regular basis, is quite intimidating because it's not exactly like the plot just jumps out of the page. It is a complex code that we are just really now beginning to understand. A lot has happened in the last 11 and a half years, but a lot more still needs to be done. Now, what are the kinds of things that we are learning? Well, for example, we now have a pretty good inventory of the small subset of letters, highlighted here in yellow, that directly code for proteins. Proteins are sort of the brick and mortar of our cells and tissues, and these are the protein coding genes. We know there's about 20 to 22,000 protein coding genes encoded in the human genome, and we have a pretty good inventory of what's there. What's actually fascinating is that that represents the minority of the functional sequences in the human genome. There is probably another few percentage that we think, at least, if not more, that is functional, is incredibly important, and we highlight it in a different color, but it's doing things other than directly coding for proteins. Among the things it's doing is it is figuring out which parts of the genome are important in different cells, something I told you about earlier. There's a reason why insulin, which is a protein made by a protein coding gene, is only expressed in a small subset of cells in the pancreas. because of this purple stuff that basically is like a dimmer switch on a wall that says insulin gene, you only get turned on in those subset of cells in the pancreas. Similarly, there's certain cells, certain proteins only made in certain blood types and certain blood cells, and those are all controlled through this exquisite choreography of these dimmer switches, which represents a subset of these purple sequences. Oh, and it's even far more complicated than that, by the way, because we are learning increasingly, as you'll hear from the second speaker, that our DNA function is conferred not only by the primary sequence of the G's, A's, T's, and C's, but it turns out that the DNA can actually get decorated with different modifications. And this is something called an epigenomic or epigenetic modifications in an epigenetic or epigenomic language, which I will highlight here, where certain parts of our DNA clearly are getting in some ways modified or associated with proteins, and that is influencing how our genome works. And that's getting pretty complicated. And we also are beginning to learn that DNA doesn't sit around in the nucleus of cells as an innocent linear molecule, but rather it can take on three-dimensional structures and confer function through its three-dimensional form. Well, we are spending lots of energies trying to interpret the human genome sequence, sort of a flagship effort that we have been funding for a number of years now as a program called ENCODE for Encyclopedia of DNA Elements. ENCODE is an international program that we are funding that is basically, like on the previous slide, highlighting all the functional sequences in the human genome and developing a catalog of them for scientists around the world to access the information through the internet and help facilitate their studies. Increasingly, anybody can go to a browser and see zoomed in versions of the human genome with this crazy pattern that you see here. To simplify this for you, this is an immense amount of data about one region of the human genome, and think of it like a GPS in your car. Whereas the DNA sequence provides the roadmap, but you want your GPS, you really want it to give you all sorts of information, like where's the nearest gas station, where's the nearest McDonald's, where's the nearest restaurant, and so forth. And that's what this information does. It's telling us where's the nearest functional sequence, where's the nearest gene, where's the nearest dimmer switch, and so on and so forth. So I've collapsed an immense amount of information about what we've learned in the human genome to two slides. Let me just say that a decade from now, 2 decades from now, 3 decades from now, we will still be interpreting and reinterpreting the human genome sequence, sort of like a great novel. We've learned a lot in the first 11 and a half years, but it's the kind of thing we will be doing quite significantly for decades to come and probably even generations to come. A second major step in this progression to bring genomic medicine into focus is basically involved the following. When the Genome Project ended, we had sequenced the first human genome, but we recognized that to really understand how the genome works and eventually use that information to understand disease and eventually improve the care of patients, we needed to be able to very inexpensively sequence DNA and sequence genomes. And so we needed new methods for sequencing genomes. Literally, the day the Genome Project ended, we launched a major program to stimulate research in this area. It's now written about in major articles, such as this one that came out this year, because we named the program the $1,000 genome. It was basically a goal to try to get technologies that would allow us to sequence a human genome for something like $1,000. And now the fact of the matter is it's been remarkable what has happened both through this program and through the private sector's investment in technology development and refinement for sequencing. Shown here is sort of an iconic view of a graph that we regularly update. Let me just tell you what you're looking at. In white is a depiction of Moore's Law. Moore's Law is associated with the computer industry in particular, that says compute power doubles every 24 months or so. The y-axis is logarithmic, and so Moore's Law is a nice line. And in green is basically the cost of sequencing a human genome as we've been collecting data and plotting it since the middle of the Genome Project. And what you can see in about 2007, 2008, we no longer just kept up with Moore's Law. We actually sort of blew it out of the water. And we did that because new technologies had come on board that basically made the cost of sequencing become just remarkably lower and lower and lower and lower. And in fact, that trend is continuing, and it's been incredible what has really happened. It's been totally transformative. To give you a flavor, that first sequence of the human genome that was generated as part of the Human Genome Project, it cost about $1 billion or so, depends exactly how you do the accounting, about $1 billion. It also didn't happen overnight. I mean, it took 6 to 8 years of thousands of scientists working on this, actually sequencing human DNA to deliver it. not exactly the kind of thing one would imagine for a clinical test. But today, fast forward, based on the kinds of trends that I showed on the previous slide, and using fancy new methods for sequencing genomes, you can generate a human genome sequence for something on the order of $2,000 to $4,000. It depends exactly what kind of quality and exactly how you do the bookkeeping. And you could generate it for something like 1 to 3 days. Probably within the next year, the cost expected to go below $1,000 and is also expected to be in less than a day you can deliver that. This has been, in fact, one of the most impressive technology development efforts ever undertaken in biomedical research and has completely been catalytic to the field. I wanted to point out there's even newer technologies that are coming on board that will help drive the cost down below $1,000. One of the ones, which may or may not prove to be successful, we don't know, is this fancy device shown here, which literally plugs into the USB port of your laptop computer and can allegedly sequence a human genome in something like a day for something like under $1,000. Truly remarkable that you don't even need a laboratory to do this. You could do this off a laptop. It's also pretty remarkable because the company continues to promise me that that device will work equally well on a PC or a Macintosh computer, which is sort of reassuring. The slide I was just introducing you to is you even see articles like this appearing in Business Insider where they now say that it'll soon cost less to sequence a genome than to flush a toilet. And then that with that, we'll change medicine forever. It's a sort of a disturbing metaphor in some ways. But at the same time, it illustrates an important point is that generating data is not what any of us think about much anymore. We can generate tremendous amounts of data very inexpensively. It's actually analyzing that data that becomes a challenge, but in fact, we're tackling those challenges in various ways. So with that in hand, having both a better understanding of the human genome and then having better and better methods for generating sequence of new genomes and different people's genomes, it really gave us the opportunity to move to the next step. And the next step basically was an acknowledgement that we're not just interested in a hypothetical human genome like the Human Genome Project generated or even one person's genome. We're actually interested in each of our genomes. In fact, ultimately, we're interested in each of our patients' genomes. And the reason for that is because we're all a little different. But it turns out that it's not like we're all totally different. In fact, there's a lot of differences in our genomes that we actually have in common. And so the next major step that has been undertaken is to get a much better catalog of the variation that is out there in all the genomes and people in this auditorium, across this city, across this country, and in fact, across the globe. And various efforts have taken place since the Human Genome Project to basically catalog and come up with some of the more common variants that are out there in the population, make that data available to scientists through the internet. The most recent of these efforts is something called Thousand Genomes Project, which basically not just took 1,000 genomes, which is what it originally did, but in fact was overachiever and is now up over 2,500 genomes, but did this by collecting samples from 26 populations from across the world to get as much geographical diversity as possible, sequencing those genomes, and then through a pilot effort that was described here and then a subsequent follow-up paper analyzing the first 1,000 has generated literally tens of millions of variants that are now available that we know about. In fact, this project is winding down and has taken us to maybe when the Genome Project was nearing its end, we knew about maybe tens of thousands of variants that were of aware to us. And now it's getting close to 100 million variants that we have a catalog to be able to use that information to now go on and study to figure out which of those variants are relevant in health and disease. The other thing efforts like this have taught us by now sequencing many, many thousands of, 2,500 genomes here, is to start to give us a feel about what a typical person's genome looks like. And that is particularly interesting from a diagnostic point of view, beginning to understand when you encounter a patient, and if you have a genome sequence of that patient, what that might look like. And so just to give you some take-home numbers, because it's sort of fun to have a summary like this, what does a typical genome look like by the numbers? Well, first thing is a typical genome has about 6 billion letters in it, nucleotides. It's 6 billion because you got 3 billion from mom, you got 3 billion from dad. So in aggregate, your genome in aggregate is a diploid, two copies of every chromosome. That's why you're about 6 billion letters we would sequence when we sequenced your genome. If you do the arithmetic, and in fact it bears out, indeed is true, is that any one of us carries about 3 to 5 million single letter or single nucleotide differences or variants compared to, say, the person sitting next to you or compared to a reference genome sequence of human. So each of us have about 3 to 5 million variants, but in fact, most of those variants we've seen. We've cataloged. It's out there on the databases. It's only a small subset that's actually unique to any one individual. In fact, about for any given person, only about 150,000 of those 3 to 5 million variants are unique to that individual, or at least not necessarily unique to that, has not been seen before. It probably is not unique to that individual, probably their other family members. It might be relatively rare. That's why we haven't seen it before. Now, each of us carries about 60 variants in our genome that truly is unique to us that didn't exist in either parent, because in the process of replicating all that DNA in the two cells that came together to make you, there were a couple oopses in that process that the couple errors got introduced. And so each of us is a little unique that we have 60 variants on average that neither of our parents have. So that's what a typical person looks like. And of course, it leads to the next obvious thing is that what role do any of these variants play in health and disease? And of course, that's really where we're heading in all of this, is to use this information to be able to understand disease processes in general and the role the genome variants play in that, and eventually to use this for understanding disease processes in individual patients. So the fourth step I want to tell you about, of course, is now using genomics to elucidate basically the biological or the genomic bases of disease. Now, to really appreciate what has happened in 11 and a half years, and a lot has happened in 11 and a half years, you have to recognize the distinction between two major classes of disease that are out there. By the way, virtually every disease, in fact, essentially every disease has at least a genomic and genetic influence, if not an overt cause. But the underlying nature of those contributions are quite different depending upon whether you're talking about rare diseases or common diseases. So let me explain. One class of diseases that we talk about are rare diseases. These are diseases like cystic fibrosis and Huntington's disease and sickle cell anemia. That these are disorders that are rare in the population, but it turns out that they're simple from a genomic point of view because it is typically a single gene that has a mutation in it that breaks that gene. And that is represented here by this large, big part of the blue on the pie chart. And it's basically a reflection that breaking a single gene is the dominant risk for getting the disease. Yeah, there might be some other genomic variants that influence severity, and there might be some environmental influence. But by and large, these are what are known as single gene disorders, monogenic, also known as Mendelian disorders, named after the famous geneticist Gregory Mendel. Now, rare diseases are obviously devastating to families and are important clinically, but they, in aggregate, don't represent the major healthcare burden worldwide. The major healthcare burden worldwide are these diseases. These are common diseases. These are diseases that are things like hypertension, diabetes, autism, Alzheimer's disease, cardiovascular disease, and so forth. The problem with common diseases, besides the fact that they're common, is that they're complicated. It's not a single gene that is basically causing the disease, but rather it is a series of variants that conspire together in some way that often involves a greater contribution of the environment to manifest itself as actually resulting in disease. Rare diseases are obviously much more tractable because you're looking for sort of one defective gene. Common diseases are far more complicated because you're looking for small contributions from multiple variants across the genome. And there's lots of question how we would be able to mobilize genomics in a way that would get at the molecular basis and genomic basis of rare and common diseases. And each has taken a different path, although there's good progress on both. Just to briefly summarize, when the Genome Project began, we knew about the genomic cause of 61 rare diseases, 61 diseases for which we knew what gene was broken. If you fast forward to today, that number is closer to 5,000 or so. And that's remarkable, and it's been accelerated by recent progress in particular. But it's not the whole story, because it doesn't mean we know the genomic basis of all rare diseases. And in fact, there's another 1,600 or so that we think a single gene is involved and haven't figured it out. And then on top of that, about another 1,700 that we think a single gene is what's causing it, and we don't know what the answer is there either. Our goal is to fill in this pie chart, and we have a major program called the Centers for Mendelian Genomics, where we now have set up medium-sized centers to tackle the challenge of trying to identify the genomic basis of those remaining slices of the pie on the previous slide. And they are making quite good progress, as are other international efforts, to really close the gap of knowledge on the remaining rare diseases we haven't figured out what the gene is. The situation with common diseases is obviously going to be a much longer term one because of the complexities of what we're trying to go after. Shown here is a summary graphic that depicts in cartoon form each of the 24 human chromosomes, and they seemingly are filled up with lollipops, these little circles of different colors. And I really don't want to go into too much detail, but what has basically what has happened over the last 7 years in particular is using the knowledge of these tens of millions of variants that we now know are in the population, a series of studies, in fact, almost 2,000 such studies have been done that allow you to basically ask questions about, of those variants that we now know about, can we try to develop correlations between inheriting certain variants, which we know where they are on the chromosomes, and basically manifesting a disease like hypertension, diabetes, asthma, cardiovascular disease, and so forth. And the answer is, it turns out you can develop these statistical associations. And when you do get such a statistical association, you put a little lollipop there and says, this is a region you want to study in greater detail to try to figure out what variant might sit in that region that confers risk for the disease. Bottom line is, we don't have the answers for most of these diseases yet, but we've gone from sort of being really clueless as to even where to look in the human genome to now having very discrete regions, which for each one we can go in and do much more detailed studies, get complete inventories of all the variants in those regions across what will probably be thousands of individuals with and without the disease, and use that information to figure out what variant is the one that is somehow influencing a biological process that results in a greater risk for getting a disease like hypertension. And there's a whole set of things going on this, which won't be as easy as rare diseases, but needless to say, I think anybody involved in this field would tell you that we have greatly advanced our knowledge in terms of progress towards getting at the variants responsible that play a role in common diseases, with full anticipation that, you know, over the next 10 years, you're going to see remarkable additional information as we drill down deeper and deeper. But of course, I've now summarized activities that have gotten us to the point of understanding disease processes, but I've really said nothing about actually changing the practice of medicine. So that's really the fifth and final step I want to tell you about. And here, it really is about implementing genomic medicine, and I want to stress that this is not going to happen overnight, and there's a lot of research that still needs to be done to sort of make that a reality. So let me take a step back for a minute and just show you this graphic, which is sort of the centerpiece of this strategic plan I told you about that we published several years ago. But this really is an organizing framework. In some ways, it nicely summarizes some things I want to say before I tell you about genomic medicine initiatives. So along the top are sort of five research domains that sort of start at the far left, looking at very basic questions about how genomes are put together and how genomes work. That middle domain is all about understanding how diseases come about. And then the fourth and the fifth domain on the right are all about using genomics to advance medical science and actually changing the way we practice medicine in an effective way. And we think of that as this progression from very basic scientific questions to clinical applications. And then all these colored dots just basically represent a graphical representation, hypothetically, of where have been the accomplishments over different time intervals. You sort of look at the interval during the Human Genome Project. All the accomplishments were pretty much focused on understanding how genomes were put together, the structure of genomes. And then when the Genome Project ended, it started to progress a little rightward as we began understanding how the genome works. And so through efforts like ENCODE that I told you about, you can see significant progress towards understanding the biology of genomes. Really, the time interval we're in now, which is the one I really wanted to emphasize, between now and the end of the decade, really shows a spreading out of these accomplishments across almost all of these domains, with the most clinically oriented one being the least populated. But I really want to stress that, you know, we continue to will have to invest significantly in what I call basic genomics. We will continue to need to interpret and reinterpret and understand the functional complexities of the human genome. We need better technologies for sequencing DNA. We will continue to catalog variants and so on and so forth. What I just emphasized to you prior to this slide for several slides was where some of the greatest accomplishments are going to be between now and the end of the decade, and that's what I would call discovering the role that variants play in rare diseases and in common diseases. And in fact, I think this is going to be the major headlines over the next 5 years, will be significant progress to really understanding what the role the genome plays in rare and common diseases. But none of that
is about clinical applications, which are out here in what I would refer to as genomic medicine, these more clinically oriented domains related to medical science and related to healthcare. And notice there's not much red in there in terms of not much sort of heat being brought to this in terms of many accomplishments piling up on each other. But what we are trying to do, and what I think the community is very much trying to do, is to now launch into research projects here and now that will build a foundation that will lead to the kind of progress that we expect beyond 2020, where I think you'll see spectacular advances and accomplishments in genomic medicine. So let me just briefly tell you what we are doing in terms of to bring in this sort of this heat, if you will, on this density plot. In particular, let me tell you what I think are some of the hottest areas in genomic medicine. And in fact, I'm telling you about this because these are areas that we are significantly investing in and that I think are very much things you're going to be hearing about. The first thing is related to cancer, which I've said nothing about, but one of our other speakers tonight is absolutely going to tell you a lot about cancer and cancer genomics. It is probably the lowest hanging fruit to talk about. The way I like to think of it is this is about getting better and better diagnostic tools. You know, we didn't always have radiographic imaging as standard of practice for medical care, but we do now. And increasingly, I think, as you're going to hear from one of the other speakers, the notion of using genomics and the tools of genomics to open up and read out the genome of a cancer, because cancer is basically a disease of a genome where the DNA has become deranged, if you will, to develop sort of a map of alterations that have taken place in that cancer that really, in a signature-like way, points to what is really wrong and also, more importantly, how best to treat that cancer, is going to become mainstream, as you're going to hear about. And if you didn't hear about it through the speaker later this evening, you would hear about it on the news, or you're going to hear about it in advertisements. In fact, just when I got into my hotel, I think it was Friday night when I got to San Diego, put on the television, and an ad from this same organization was playing on your radio or your TV station locally. And it was talking about cancer treatment, and it was talking about genomics this and genomics that, and because genomics is becoming very much a key part of cancer care, as you'll hear about in one of the other speakers. I think the second area of low-hanging fruit worth mentioning is in the arena of something called pharmacogenomics. Big, complicated word, but really pretty simple. It's about pharmacology, medications, and so forth, and genomics, with its underlying principle simply one that everybody responds differently. We are all a little bit different. You know, we all respond a little bit differently to roller coaster rides. Well, guess what? We also all respond a little bit differently to medications. And this has been an evolving field of great interest, recognizing that just like variants play a role in disease processes, variants play a role in how we metabolize drugs. And it is no wonder that those variants are influencing drug response, that the practice of medicine has always involved giving out medications that physicians know will not work in everybody. And we are now beginning to untangle the complexities of what goes on in drug metabolism and how genomic variants influence some of the processes involved in how medications work and are explaining why some of us are responders or non-responders to a given medication. And increasingly, what you're going to be hearing about is using genomic information about patients to give them the right drug to the right person at the right dosage. And it's a recognition that one size does not fit all. And for a long time, this was hypothetical, and increasingly, this is going to become mainstream. I predict between now and the end of the decade, there'll be many medications for which that genomic information will be used as part of making decisions about what medications to give an individual. There is a significant enough progress that has gone on in both cancer genomics and in the use of pharmacogenomics and in some other applications that we recognized several years ago that it was time to actually start testing this out, to actually trying to use genome sequencing as part of clinical care. And so we launched a couple of programs now that I call test drive programs. These are programs that say, hey, we really should try to see what it is like to use genomic information about patients as part of their clinical care. But we need to do this in a research setting. We can't just sort of let this go on without making sure we sort of are studying this very carefully. So we have a couple programs. This one is several years old, called the CSER program, or Clinical Sequence and Exploratory Research Program. We now have 9 sites set up around the United States, some looking at cancer, some looking at pharmacogenomics, some looking in the pediatric period, and several other applications to simply say, what is it like to actually start to use genome sequence information about patients as part of their care? And also, what are some of the ethical issues that one encounters and some of the social issues that one needs to be studying as well? And these are teaching us some very important lessons about early deployment that one would learn on a test drive. And in fact, we're learning enough lessons about what it's like when you do this at a major academic medical center that it's getting us very motivated to start to imagine what's it going to be like when we start to deploy that in other healthcare settings, because we know that healthcare delivery is very heterogeneous in a country like the United States. And so we just in the past year have launched a new network of sites called Ignite for implementing genomics into clinical practice. And this is a network that is really being tasked with developing best practices in a number of areas of genomic medicine, and then helping us figure out how best to disseminate that to different sites around the country, especially sites of different demographics and different geographical settings and so forth, so that we can really make this a very effective network of genomic medicine sites. The reason we need to be doing studies like this is, if you ask me, one of the biggest bottlenecks associated with deploying genomic medicine widely, it really relates to this insightful article that a good colleague of ours, Jeff Ginsberg, wrote recently in Nature, where he really stresses we need more and more evidence and developing an evidence base to convince ourselves that genomic information truly is going to be an effective use for clinical care. And he just wrote in here, I thought, a very insightful sort of charge, if you will, where he said, the medical genomics community now needs to focus on how to decide what levels of evidence are required to demonstrate that assessing genomic variant helps patients. The clinical community should commit to developing ways to evaluate genomic variants as actionable, including understanding how results from one patient population might apply with differing genetic backgrounds to health or health practices. And it really, especially for the physicians in the audience, really is a recognition that there's a lot out there that we don't yet have an evidence base to totally guide clinical practice guidelines. And one of the things we hope our test drive programs will be to start to develop that evidence base. Another area which is getting a lot of attention relates to, I suppose, what I call sort of the genomics of pregnancy, if you will, or reproductive genomics. Really represents two different parts of the of pregnancy, both of which there's a lot of interesting developments and a lot of interesting issues. At the prenatal level, there's a lot of excitement around what I call non-invasive prenatal genome sequencing. The methods for sequencing DNA that we now have are so exquisitely sensitive that we can now do standard genomic studies that would typically be done after you get DNA of an unborn child through invasive methods like amniocentesis or chorionic villus sampling. You can get from a simple blood draw of a pregnant mother, because there's teeny amounts of DNA of that fetus floating around in her bloodstream. And you could do all the same things with a simple blood draw. Companies are being set up to offer that diagnostics, and it really has become game-changing. The scientific literature is just filling up with data about this, but also it's really something that's getting a lot of attention from the press as well. And in particular, even the New York Times is writing about this, because the idea that this is offering such a non-invasive way of getting genomic information about unborn babies. Now, that's one area, and this is already becoming sort of infused in practice. The other area, which is, I think, is probably certainly much more complicated, relates to this notion of, would we can contemplate, maybe this is predicted here, by 2025, having every child have their genome sequenced at birth. We already do newborn screening for a small subset of disorders, and that's standard of practice in a place like the United States. But what might a future look like where we actually have the capabilities of sequencing a genome of every baby born? We recognize this is a complicated set of issues, and we need a lot of research to investigate this, and so we launched this program called InSight, which is doing exactly that. It is basically looking to see what it is like at a logistical level, but also what are some of the ethical issues associated with doing whole genome sequencing of newborns, and this is a research endeavor that really needs to teach us some things before we would dare consider doing this on any sort of a large scale. The other next area, which I think the physicians in the audience will very much appreciate, is the recognition that this is all going to get really complicated really fast. In fact, it's already there. And we don't have systems in place that really allow us to take advantage of all this information. You know, the fact of the matter is, we should recognize that generating a human genome sequence of any individual, any patient, or even any tumor, in the case of cancer, is almost trivial. And though data just spews off these machines very, very quickly and very inexpensively. But the fact of the matter is, just because we can do it inexpensively, and even if we had that data on a patient, doesn't mean we know exactly what to do. The fact of the matter is, we don't want to have made all these advances in genomics and then go to deploy this clinically only to then round on our patients in the morning and just feel like this, simply having no idea what any of this means. And we recognize that even if the scientific community generates the information of what all this means, it doesn't mean it's interpretable down to a busy practicing physician, pharmacist, nurse, physician's assistant, or other healthcare professional. And so we recognize part of the responsibility we need to do is to develop better systems that allow us to understand what all the genomic data is telling us. And some of this should clearly be integrated with the increasing electronic nature of electronic health records and so forth. And we eventually need to make this as simple as could be that would allow us to look up this information on an iPad or another handheld device. And so we have started a program to start to build something which we refer to as ClinGen, or Clinical Genome Resource, which is really about just doing the science to figure out how to translate the knowledge coming out of all these genomic studies into something that could be readily accessed by a busy practicing healthcare professional. This is the kind of thing I'm sure will take us a long time to create, but we thought it was important to jumpstart it through some research projects to start to build such a thing to understand the nature of it. The sixth and last of these low-hanging fruit really is also a bit of a no-brainer because it's going on widespread now all over, and that relates to the idea of taking individuals with ultra-rare genetic diseases for which you don't know what's wrong with them and simply sequencing their genomes to try to get a clue. In fact, over the last couple of years, review article after review article have already been published now describing these diagnostic opportunities that exist in particular for ultra-rare genetic diseases. And this is, in fact, becoming almost standard of care for individuals for which a diagnosis has eluded physicians, in some cases multiple physicians. And I would just point to this article that just came out in Nature talking about when disease strikes from nowhere, these true medical mysteries we cannot figure out what's going on. You talk about how the fact that now children born with disorders not readily explained by standard tests can sometimes be diagnosed through genome sequencing and analysis. Often these patients have multi-$100,000 of workup, and doing a genome sequence for 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 just makes complete sense and is often quite effective. And so the idea of using genomics as part of a standard armamentarium for dealing with ultra-rare diseases is really very much reached the fore. At the National Institutes of Health, we started a program, something called the Undiagnosed Diseases Program, to take in patients from around the world, actually, but particularly in the country, bring them in and have genomics be a cornerstone of the workup of those patients, and it's been remarkably successful. So successful that NIH has just nationalized this network and shown here the new sites that were just named a few weeks ago that are now going to be augmenting the site at NIH to now provide a national network of sites to deal with these ultra-rare disorders. So that's the landscape I wanted to paint for you. But I also want to stress something as I tie this all together with why we're at this museum and why we are sitting here also prior to this event, prior to these talks, looking at this exhibition. And it really relates to the fact that I've been involved in genomics since the beginning, so it's like 27 years, but it really has changed a lot in those 27 years. You know, when I got involved in it straight out of medical school, it was really just about a bunch of us geeky scientists. I mean, we were at the bench, we were analyzing DNA, we were at the computer, we were analyzing sequence, but it was scientists. It was biomedical researchers. You know, when the Genome Project ended, you know, clearly we started to get healthcare professionals engaged in being research partners with us, and increasingly they have thought about and helped us figure out how genomics might eventually be applied to medicine. But I think the real change that's going on now, and it's the reason why this exhibition has come to be and why I'm very passionate about thinking about some of these issues around the relevance of genomics, is because genomics is becoming relevant to families. And because patients are involved. Now, genomics is becoming mainstream as part of medical care in some settings, and which means it's relevant to all of us. Now, I tell you that, and you may want to say, well, is that really true? Let me show you some examples. You know, without a question, this is coming in on the newsstand, left and right. I think Angelina Jolie's story, when she came out about her particular medical circumstance, was caught a lot of attention, as featured here. Time magazine continues to follow these sorts of things. They just can't, this is on your newsstand now in your grocery store, a special thick issue of Time talking about how DNA shapes your life. So it's all over the newsstand. It's also all over coming into our living rooms. I told you about in my hotel room Friday night. I saw one of your cancer centers advertised on one of your local television channels. In the Washington, D.C. area, starting this past summer, I was seeing this commercial that featured an advertisement from one of our local healthcare delivery systems.
Some say your health is the luck of the draw. But Inova's groundbreaking genomic research is working to change that. We're studying the genetic makeup of infants to detect if, when, and how disease may occur, so we can learn to tailor the best care for each patient. Providing individualized health care, anticipating and preventing illness. That's predictive medicine. Inova. Join the future of health.
So, and I hear from colleagues that similar ads are running in other venues and other cities and other healthcare networks. So this is streaming into our living rooms. We're seeing this all the time on the newsstand. And part of this reflects the fact that this isn't just about science anymore. This is also as much about society. And we think a lot about ethical issues and social issues and legal issues that are all related to genomics. And there's many topics we could talk about, and maybe we will in the discussion period. The one that really greatly motivates us, or one of the ones that greatly motivates us, relates to just the literacy around genomics, especially in the general public, because this is going to become relevant for their medical care. And this is what led us to have conversations with another government agency, in particular the Smithsonian Institution. So here we were at the National Institutes of Health with a responsibility for genomics research. But, you know, just 10 miles away, of course, is the Smithsonian Institution, in particular the National Museum of Natural History. And through a series of conversations we had, we quickly decided it was time to have a major partnership, and the rest is a bit history. We decided to put together the exhibition that's up here right now, a couple floors above us, or one floor above us, called Genome Unlocking Life's Code, which after, in rapid fashion, we put this together in 2 years, and normally would take 4 or 5 or 6 years to put an exhibition like this together. We did it in 2 years so that it could open June of last year, which was also opened in 2013 to commemorate the 10th anniversary of the completion of the Human Genome Project. It was there in the Natural History Museum for 14 months, during which time about 3.6 million people walked through that exhibition. But then it ended up, as we had always planned, at the end of August, it was boxed up and put on trucks and put on the road. And stop one was here, because we recognized that we didn't want to just have people in D.C. see this. We wanted to have a tour, which it will do for 4 to 5 years, so that more families can come see this and more student groups can come see this. Stop one is right here. And then when it ends its tour here in early January, it'll go up the coast, up to San Jose. And then when it's done with San Jose, it goes St. Louis, Portland, Milwaukee, and the list goes on. And so that's the story of this exhibition. I also want to let you know, besides seeing it, when you're here in the museum, there is a website associated with this. It's easy to remember, unlockinglifescode.org. And I strongly urge you, if you like the exhibition, please go to this website. It has terrific amounts of material in it, lots of educational outreach materials. In D.C. area, over those 14 months, we put on many programs like the program you're having tonight. And we videotaped most of those and put all those up on YouTube. And there's links from this site to all these other programs and lots of lectures and so on and so forth. So that's the story behind the exhibition. And that's the sort of the landscape, if you will, of genomics. And let me just leave you with one last thing. If you're at all interested in being updated about what's going on in genomics, especially what's going on in our institute, I now have a monthly newsletter that I send out to anybody who wants to receive it. And if you just go to that URL and click your way down, you could sign up to be on the listserv to get a monthly update about what's happening in genomics. So thank you very much for your attention. And I will stop there and turn the podium over to the other speakers and look forward to discussion we have. Thank you.
Well, that was a wonderful talk, and thank you very much. It was it's going to be a hard act to follow. What I would like to talk to you about is the last part of Dr. Green's talk, that is the clinical space, what we are doing now in the clinical space with genomics, especially in the context of cancer. So I came to San Diego about a year and a half ago. I spent before that most of my career at MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. And I came here to do several things, but mainly lead a new center for personalized cancer therapy, because clearly genomics is making an impact on cancer. So that's what I want to go through with you. So I'm going to start with what we've learned so far. What are the lessons that we've learned? So the first lesson is that cancer is complicated, and we can't just use one drug. We need combinations of drugs, and those combinations of drugs need to be matched to the abnormalities found in cancer patients. Number two is often when we treat cancer patients, we treat very advanced disease that is already metastatic, and that has very complex genomics. And we need to bring most of these technologies earlier in the disease to newly diagnosed patients where the disease is less complicated and we're better able to impact it. Number three, genomics is a disruptive technology. At least that's what we're finding. Disruptive maybe in a good way, because what it's telling us is that the way we have treated cancer for all these years and all the regulatory systems that we've set up and the way we do clinical research and the clinical practice really doesn't fit into the reality that genomics is unveiling. So we really have to change our paradigms. And if we're able to change these paradigms, I think the early results are showing that we're really going to see transformative changes in the cancer field and really in all of medicine. So just a little bit about myself, and I think this will give you a little bit of background about what informed the work that I'm going to show you in genomics. Before I came to San Diego, I was charged with building a new department at MD Anderson Cancer Center. It was a clinical trials department where we were using many of the new targeted drugs. This actually became the largest department of its type in the world. And what we did is we were really seeing thousands of patients per year. And what we did is we began in the end of 2007 to integrate molecular profiling or genomics into our patients' routine type of diagnosis. So, of course, the genomics that we were using at the end of 2007 is very primitive compared to what we have today. But nonetheless, we were able to see a real impact in our patients, which gave us the idea of the potential power of these techniques. I'm here now at UCSD. I mentioned that one of my charges is to direct a new center of personalized cancer therapy. And these are sort of the components of that center. And I want to mention that there are several reasons why UCSD is such a good place and why San Diego is such a good place to be doing this. First of all, it's one of the major biotech startups in the country, almost like the Silicon Valley of genomics. We have a major supercomputer center here. I think there's about seven in the country, and UCSD leads the consortium. So it was mentioned how complicated a lot of the bioinformatics is here. And so having the computer expertise to deal with that is very important. And finally, there are multiple institutes here that have very deep science in them, not just UCSD, but Salk, Scripps, Sanford, Burnham. I think San Diego, this always amazed me, San Diego is one of the few cities that would have the nerve to have a street called Nobel Drive. So let's talk about cancer and what we've been doing in the past and why this is really not working out for us. So these are drugs that are approved for common cancers, not unusual drugs, really routine type of drugs. And when we look at what patients can expect from them, the survival gains are minimum. Most of the survival gains are about 2 months. And the reason for that is that there's probably about 10 to 20% of patients that do well with these drugs. And the other 80 to 90% do not benefit from these drugs or are even harmed from it. So overall, when you look at the survival gains of the population of patients that you're treating, be it colon cancer or lung cancer, the overall survival gain is about 2 months. And obviously, that's not good enough for what we want to be doing. And fortunately, our new technology is beginning to help us understand what has gone wrong in the past. And this relates to what was alluded to before, the way we diagnose patients. So for instance, if we diagnose lung cancer, which is shown here. In the past, we diagnosed this as one disease. If 1,000 patients came in with lung cancer, they all had one disease. Now we understand that lung cancer is made up of multiple subsets, small subsets of diseases that are defined by their genomic abnormalities. And so it just makes sense that if you treat everybody in the same way, with whatever drug you're using, only a small percentage of patients will be impacted by that particular drug. And what we really need to be doing is getting a molecular diagnosis, a genomic diagnosis on each patient, and then matching that patient with the appropriate therapy. And we also know we've now developed multiple new drugs that are able to impact abnormal mutations, DNA signals that are abnormal in cancer cells. Some of these drugs are already FDA approved. Other drugs are in the experimental phase. But we know that these drugs are not going to work unless we give them to the right patients. So we have to match patients with the right drugs. The future is actually here. Genomic medicine is continuing to grow, but we're already doing this in the clinic, and we're already beginning to see some of the dramatic impact that this can have on patients. So this is a study that we did starting in the end of 2007 when we introduced molecular profiling into patients. It was a study that we called PREDICT for profile-related evidence determining individualized therapy. And what we did in this study is we didn't worry too much about the organ of origin of the cancer. The classic way we diagnose patients with cancer is if the cancer came from the breast, it's breast cancer. If it came from the lungs, it's lung cancer. But as I mentioned, that's not good enough. So what we concentrated on doing is looking deeper in the cells and looking at the DNA sequence that was abnormal in those cells and diagnosing patients on that way, and then matching patients with the appropriate targeted agents. And the basic premise here is, and I think this is really very important for our thinking, we keep on saying that we need better drugs to treat cancer patients. And no doubt that we do need better drugs. We always need better drugs. But that's not our most fundamental problem. I think everybody understands that if we use a drug like insulin to treat pneumonia, I know it's very simplistic, but you're going to come to the conclusion that insulin is a lousy drug and that pneumonia is a very difficult disease to treat. And I think that that's what we've been doing with cancer really for most of my career. We didn't have the tools to match patients with the right drugs, so we sort of gave them randomly. And so the conclusion can only be that it doesn't matter how good your drug is. If you don't give it to the right patients, it's not going to work very well. And this is what we began to find. This is an example with a gene called a PIK3CA. It's a gene that's commonly mutated in cancer. But I think what you can see from the slide is that it's abnormal in a certain percentage of multiple different tumors. And if you look at virtually any type of cancer, a small subset of those patients will have an abnormality in this gene. And what we found increasingly is that the molecular abnormalities did not segregate by organ of origin. So the way we classified cancer and diagnosed cancer, the genomics didn't pay too much attention to that. So this is really a reclassification of cancer based on the gene abnormalities. And as you might imagine, if one has a drug that impacts this abnormal gene, one would want to give it to the patients that have the abnormal gene rather than giving it to a group of patients with breast cancer or colon cancer, regardless of whether that abnormal gene is there, which is the old way and the classic way of doing things. So what happened, what happened when we began to use molecular profiling in our patients? This department was a department that did early clinical trials, phase one trials, which are a lot of first-in-human drugs. By definition, our cancer patients didn't come to us until they had been told that there were no further options for them, that they had failed all therapy. So these are very difficult to treat patients. And this is a waterfall plot. Most of you are probably not familiar with it, but the bottom line is that anything below the horizontal line is a response, and anything above it is the patient getting worse. And classically, in these patients, about 5% of patients respond to drugs. When you give them in the regular way, you diagnose the patient as breast cancer, you give them a drug. These are hard-to-treat patients, and 5% is obviously not a good response rate. But when we began to match patients, I think you can see that the response rates were really remarkably higher, even though we were just using first-generation technology. And we could see this every day in the clinic. When we were able to match patients, we could see they would have much more robust responses than if we couldn't match patients where we almost never got responses. I'm not going to go through this slide because Dr. Green really went through this before that, but part of the reason that we could do this and do it ever more better is because of the remarkable and startling speed with which this technology has improved. And really going from costing, my quote was $2.7 billion per genome, to taking years to do an analysis, to taking just a few days, and costing, in a practical sense, probably now about $5,000 for clinical grade sequencing. So that's now in the realm of what patients can get on a regular basis. So what are we finding when we use this sequencing? So this is, I think we're finding things, and this is that are really unique and interesting, and this is why I believe that genomics is a disruptive technology. We looked at a series of breast cancer patients, and this is just one example, a series of 75 breast cancer patients, and they all had metastatic disease. And what we found was that there was no two that were alike. The slide will not accommodate 75 patients, but you'll have to take my word for it. But I think you can the slide shows sequences on different patients. And the main point of showing the sequences, these are the genes that are abnormal in these patients. And the main point of showing it is I think you can see that each patient is different. The reason this is disruptive is that the way we do clinical research in cancer and the way we do clinical practice is that we try to find things that are alike among patients and then group them on the same study. First, we try to diagnose them by organ of origin, which was breast cancer or lung cancer. Now we try to find genes that are the same, abnormal in the same way in multiple tumors, and put them on the same drug. And that is moving us forward, but slowly, because ultimately what we really need to be doing and what makes sense from this is that we need to be giving every individual a different therapy. And furthermore, what has come into the clinic is really clinical grade genomics that we're using now, really quite regular basis. But this is just the tip of the iceberg. We haven't touched the transcriptome, which is the RNA or the protein or the epigenetic changes. So there's really a lot more that we can still learn. So how can we change cancer? What are we learning? The first thing we're learning is that in metastatic disease or advanced disease, where the disease is complicated, we need to use combinations of customized agents. But we're also learning that there's another way forward, and that's to treat earlier in the course of the disease. And I want to give you an example of a disease that was transformed in my career, and that's a leukemia. So bringing this technology to newly diagnosed solid tumors hasn't happened, but it has happened in leukemia. And there's a disease called chronic myelogenous leukemia, which I think is a really great model. This disease was a death sentence. Everybody died who had this disease, usually in 4 or 5 years. Today, this disease it's been totally transformed. The median survival is about 20 to 25 years. And since the median age of diagnosis is about 60, most of these patients will not die of their disease. So let's understand what happened here as a model for going forward. One of the main things that happened is that we discovered the underlying genetic abnormality in these patients. We also discovered a drug called imatinib that was able to impact that abnormality. But in solid tumors, we've done this too, and yet we haven't seen these dramatic changes. And so many people feel that solid tumors like colon and lung cancer are more complicated, but I want to show you why that might not be true. This is a patient that has metastatic tumor, and obviously a lot of tumor, and this patient was given a matched therapy, and their tumors got much better. I think you can see that. But what inevitably happens in the patients that we treat with metastatic disease is that it comes back. They may get a reprieve for 6 or 9 months or a year, but then the disease comes back. And that's really different than the leukemia. So one hypothesis is that the leukemia is a different type of disease. But another hypothesis is that we're doing things differently in that leukemia, and we could learn an important lesson from the right way to do it. And I believe the latter to be true. So let's look what happens more carefully in that leukemia. If we use our match therapy in end-stage patients, the response rate's actually only about 10%. And the average survival today is only about 1 year, which is better than the 6 months it used to be, but not transformative. But if we bring the therapy up front to newly diagnosed patients, now the response rates are near 100%, and the median survival went from about 5 years to 20 years. So if metastases in solid tumors, the advancement of solid tumors, is equivalent to end-stage leukemia, what we need to be doing is treating patients earlier in the disease and recognize that the key features that led to the transformation of CML was not just knowing the target, because we know that for a lot of solid tumors. And it was not just knowing the target and matching patients, because we can do that with solid tumors and we get responses, but they don't last. But the third part of that was to treat newly diagnosed patients, not waiting until the patients had end-stage disease, but while the disease was simpler. We haven't done that yet in solid tumor patients. So I want to go through some of the things that we're doing at the Center for Personalized Cancer Therapy. One of the things that we developed was a molecular tumor board. As was mentioned, this genomic information is complicated, and physicians aren't used to it. It's something totally new to them. And so what we found is that we had to get physicians together in a room with bioinformatics specialists, with basic scientists, with our people from the supercomputer, and they can present the patients who have had genomic profiling and get a consensus opinion on what can be done for those patients. And that made the physicians much more comfortable with understanding that information and actually acting on it. We've been using new cutting-edge technology to look at our patients, and I want to mention that. I mentioned the supercomputer center. Many of these patients, especially with advanced disease, have multiple aberrations. This is a patient with stomach cancer. He has six abnormalities. It's very hard to give a patient. Six different drugs. So with understanding bioinformatics, we can understand convergence pathways and try to give patients not six different drugs, but three drugs if we understand the pathways that are abnormal. The other thing that we've been doing, beginning to do, is look in the blood, do what we call liquid biopsies. So usually we do biopsies by looking at the tissue, but we now can take DNA that is shed into the bloodstream from the tumor, do sequencing on it, and then not even have to do a tissue biopsy, but understand the sequence just based on a blood test. And this is already in the clinic. We're trying to build very robust clinical studies. So this is one called WINTER that includes not only advanced genomics, but advanced transcriptomics, advanced RNA in it. And I mentioned how important it is to go to newly diagnosed patients. So we're beginning to look at patients that have very poor prognosis, things like pancreatic cancer, where patients only 7% are alive at 2 years. And we're about to launch a study called iPredict that is going to be looking at these patients and giving them genomic match therapy in the newly diagnosed state. And hereditary cancer predispositions, that's another really important area, not looking just at the tumor, but also looking at the patient themselves. And this is always one of my favorite examples. So does this woman who reached 100 smoking like a chimney, is that good luck? Or does she metabolize carcinogens differently? Can our understanding of the patient themselves help us understand their immune system, what toxicities they may have with drugs, and so forth? And finally, although cancer is at the cutting edge, we believe that this is going to revolutionize all of medicine. And this is an example that really fascinates me personally. Left-hand side, you see a patient with bladder cancer, and these patients often have abnormalities in a gene called FGFR3. Interestingly enough, when that gene is inherited as an abnormal way, often exactly the same as the gene that's abnormal, created abnormal in a bladder tumor patient, if it's in the hereditary form and you're born with it, you have dwarfism. So the question is, we're now developing drugs that target that gene for cancer patients. Is it possible that we will be able to impact the way children with dwarfism might grow with drugs that impact these abnormalities as well? And I'm going to stop. San Diego is actually, I'm new here, but it's a very beautiful city. And thank you very much for listening.
Well, thank you very much. And I want to thank the organizers also for for inviting me. These are tough acts to follow. I'm Gary Feierstein from UCSD. I'm the director of the Clinical and Translational Research Institute. And you've heard two elegant presentations, one describing the remarkable advances in genomics overall, and then secondly, how this can be applied in the clinic, particularly in cancer, but also potentially for rare diseases, as was just alluded to at the end. My perspective that I'll try to present is to try to manage expectations somewhat, that we have made these tremendous strides. And when one talks about cancer or rare diseases, it's fairly clear that the translation into clinically relevant outcomes and interventions or diagnostics is clear. But when we get to either what are called common diseases or more complex diseases, that is not nearly so clear. And if you think about the blueprints and the sequence of the DNA, and you make if I torture that that metaphor a little bit, that's like the 50% schematics. And really, all those things that decorate DNA that were alluded to earlier are what get you to the 95 or 100% schematics when you're trying to build a structure. So here is personalized medicine, and I can't avoid poking a little bit of fun at it, because while it is clear that the strides have been tremendous and in the short term have been revolutionized by clinical investigators like Dr. Kurzrock, we're not necessarily going to see the same rapid progress elsewhere. And so this shows what lemmings believe in their leaping off the cliff. And I say this with apologies to Dr. Samuel Johnson, who had a quote for everything. And actually, this is the triumph of hope over experience. The actual quote came from Dr. Johnson's description of second marriages. So you've already heard quite a bit, and I won't belabor this. In cancer, mutations are really paramount, although, as Dr. Kurzrock pointed out, there are transcriptomics and proteomics and epigenetic changes that are going to be very important in terms of how we ultimately personalize therapy. And it is quite complicated, particularly in advanced diseases, because tumors are very smart. They can change. So if you look at different parts of a single tumor, there can be different mutations. Those are also different from those at distant sites. I think this is one of the critical reasons why treating earlier is going to be one of the most essential components to personalizing therapy based on genomics in cancer. And I also wanted to present a cautionary tale related to pharmacogenomics. So this received great fanfare a couple of years ago when clopidogrel was associated, its toxicity and benefit was associated with some single nucleotide polymorphisms in particular genes associated with the metabolism of that disease. Now it made perfect sense. It made biologic sense and medical sense that you should be able to do this test and be able to predict who should or should not get the disease, who should or should not get the drug. This was also commented on by the FDA, but to make a long story short, when you go from a couple thousand patients to tens of thousands of patients with a variety of genetic backgrounds, actually, it turns out that the test has very little utility. A meta-analysis of all of the data showed that overall, really, you could not use this single nucleotide polymorphism to decide who should or should not get the test in the clinic, and that if you used it, you would potentially be denying people that particular therapy. Now, there's very little doubt that pharmacogenomics is going to end up being important, and that if we end up dissecting out ethnic, racial, and other background differences in terms of the genomics of these individuals, we might be able to then ultimately apply these tests in a more rational basis. But again, the notion is that we really have to manage expectations, particularly when we have, what are putatively breakthroughs. And what we don't want to do is overpromise and underdeliver on some of these interesting advances. So when one gets to complex diseases, they are, well, complex. So this is a number of diseases. It was called the Manhattan plot. So each of the chromosomes is shown along the x-axis, and where you see peaks are where there are major genetic associations. And we see a variety of diseases
bipolar disorder, coronary artery disease, Crohn's disease, hypertension, rheumatoid arthritis, type 1 and type 2 diabetes. And in each case, there are some fairly significant associations, but even when you see these fairly large peaks, these end up having a relatively modest influence on susceptibility of disease. And I'm going to come back to that in a few minutes to rheumatoid arthritis as a sort of a prototypical complex immune-mediated disease. The vast majority of what looks like noise on the bottom are SNPs or genomic variants that have a modest effect, either increasing the odds ratio, 5%, 1.05 or 1.1, and there are a few that are more than that. And you probably have to have hundreds of these in order to account for the full genetic load, and no single one will actually add up to guaranteeing you're going to get that disease. And in fact, it's actually quite difficult, even with some sophisticated informatics, to use combinations of these relatively mild influences in order to try to improve the prognostic capacity of someone who walks into the clinic and asks, will I get, for instance, hypertension? Some of the advances, really, as we've discussed already today, are related to rare diseases. And there's no question that as you go from the most rudimentary sequencing to whole genome sequencing, you really can find causative mutations. And shown on the left, for individuals that have a deep neurologic phenotype for children, if you just use not terribly sophisticated techniques in today's environment, where you do array assays, you can only find causative mutations in a relatively small percentage. If you take one wedge of this and you do whole genome sequencing, you actually pick up quite a few more. And if you take a wedge of this and you do whole genome sequencing, it's clear that you really start to find out the causative mutations. So again, there's very little question that for rare diseases with a deep phenotype, this approach is going to clearly identify what the causes are, and they are largely genetic. But when you start looking at the more complex diseases or the more common diseases, there are experiments in Nature that allow us or that provide information on really how much the genes, the blueprint themselves actually contribute to susceptibility. So I've shown a bunch of them up here, showing monozygotic and dizygotic twins. So, for example, if you have if you have dizygotic twins and one of them has lupus, the risk that the dizygotic twin will get lupus is 2%. If it's a monozygotic twin, it goes up quite a bit, 24%, but it is certainly not 100%. The same thing is true with a variety of these other diseases. The one that I'm going to talk about in a minute is rheumatoid arthritis, where in the general population, the risk is about 1%. Dizygotic twins, it's 5%, and it's actually about 12 to 15% in monozygotic twins. So if you sequence everybody's genome in the room, you would miss 85% or more of the risk of developing rheumatoid arthritis. So having that genome sequence, I think, will be informative, but will be unlikely in isolation to be able to provide clinical information that would be actionable. Well, we're here on a genomics symposium, and one of the questions is, why are we studying genomics? And it is in part because it was the first out of the blocks. And this is an old joke. The drunk is walking around looking for his keys, and the police officer walks up to him and says, "Why are you looking under the streetlight?" And he says, "Well, that's where the light is." So our technology for genomics has advanced so dramatically that this is where a large percentage of the effort has been placed, and rightfully so. But we're really now to the point where we need to be looking at other influences, whether it's the environment or other omics that I'll talk about momentarily, that will actually have a major impact on how the genome can potentially contribute to disease. And the environment, or even your internal environment, can sometimes be more important than your genome. So there's this rather remarkable study that was done in mice that displayed autistic behaviors. And then if you took the microbiome from the gut of the mouse, in other words, the stool, you do a stool transplant or fecal transplant, you could actually induce that phenotype in other mice. So they would develop these autistic behaviors. So this really had less to do with the genes than with the bacteria that they were carrying around with them. And in fact, these bacteria are in fact producing specific compounds that can be isolated, and those compounds can then induce those autistic-like behaviors. Now, there's clearly a genetic component to autism, as shown in numerous family studies, but the genomics alone are not accounting for it. There's clearly environmental influences that could be contributing. And we're going to hear more and more about how we interact with our environment, particularly the bacteria that account for the majority of our DNA, probably in the vessels that we call our bodies, going forward, and how that may influence a whole host of different diseases. So let's come back to rheumatoid arthritis. It's about 1% of the population. It causes this deforming arthritis that's shown on the left. And this is a blow-up of that Manhattan plot that I showed before. Here is the low-resolution view. There's HLA-DR, which is class 2 major histocompatibility. That's the major genetic influence. And all the rest of the noise down here, which is probably about 100 different genes that accounts for at least half of the genetic contribution of the gene. Each of these contributes odds ratios of about 1.05 or 1.1. The risk of getting rheumatoid arthritis goes from 1% to 4 to 6% if you have the right allele. And that's it. So if you add all of this stuff up together, as in monozygotic twins, you get it up, the risk up to 12 to 15% in that general range. So what are some of these other influences in a disease like rheumatoid arthritis? And there are a variety of influences that have been looked at. Repeated activation of innate immunity that can lead to breakdown of tolerance, environmental exposures, and much of this ends up being integrated through what's called epigenetics, which are, again, the decoration on the DNA that is not involved with changing the structure of the proteins that are encoded, but how they're regulated. So that really gets to this notion of Darwinianism versus Lamarckism. So those of you that remember reading about Lamarck, he believed that giraffes had long necks because if they just stretched their necks enough that eventually they would get longer, and those are the ones that would survive. And of course, that's not a terribly sophisticated way of looking at it. But Darwinism, or evolution, is how a species responds to the environment over the eons. If you're a bacteria, maybe over a course of a day. But in humans, it's over hundreds of thousands or millions of years. But the species has to respond to other environmental stimuli that will modify how genes are expressed in order to improve survival. And that is essentially one of the key things that epigenetics does. One of them is how one can adapt to environmental exposures in order to have short-term improved survival of the species. And the other is controlling the sequence of how genes are expressed during development. So if you want liver cells to be rapidly proliferating during fetal development, you want to eventually turn that off. And one of the ways that that's done is through epigenetics. So with epigenetics, in particular, DNA methylation, which is a process by which methyl groups are put onto deoxycytidines, can silence a variety of genes if they are methylated in the promoters. And actually, it turns out that environmental influences over which you have no control over can control your risk of disease as you grow up. So this is an interesting study that was done in mice where pregnant mice were fed either low or high methyl donor diets. So the high methyl donor diets leads to more DNA methylation on the pups that are born, and actually the pups of the pups two generations later. Low methylation donors have, again, lower amounts of DNA methylation. So if you look at the pups, They did nothing wrong. Their mothers were being fed the high methyl donor diets. But these mice, actually in an asthma model, ended up having a much greater increase in the risk of asthma. So it wasn't because their DNA was different. It was because the way their DNA was marked or decorated was changed. And actually, the mechanism is by changing the balance of T cells that are involved with allergic responses versus other types of adaptive immune responses. So as if you needed something else to blame your mother, here is yet something else. So we have actually begun looking at DNA methylation patterns in some of these diseases. Shown here is rheumatoid arthritis. So we look at the cells from the joints of patients with RA, and we look at DNA methylation in osteoarthritis as the control on the top and rheumatoid arthritis in the bottom. And this is a heat map, and where it's red, it shows higher genes that are, or loci that have higher methylation, and where it's blue, it's lower. And the key point of this is that we can actually tell the difference between control and RA cells based solely on their DNA methylation pattern. And the DNA and the genes that are abnormal in here are not random. They're genes that are involved with immune regulation. So it is not just the genes that, the sequence of the genes, but how they're regulated that is essential in terms of ultimately, I believe, assessing and developing risk. I believe that this is in part the dark matter that contributes to this 85% or so of risk that we still have fairly poorly defined in some of these common diseases. And in terms of trying to understand more deeply the disease and ultimately develop novel therapeutics, we are now beginning to integrate different disease omics platforms. Shown here is looking at the genomics, the genes that are associated with RA, and integrating that with transcriptomics and with the DNA methylation pattern, and then combining that with the ENCODE database, which you heard about a little while ago, and finding hotspots where there are multiple omics data sets that are pointing to it, and basically a signpost that says, please look here for a potentially very important gene or pattern of regulation that can potentially be used to treat this disease. So, just in conclusion, I wanted to point out that we've made lots of progress in terms of genomics. I think it, of course, is indisputable that there's a major contribution to health and disease. But that a single omics platform by itself is probably not going to get us ultimately to the answers in some of the more common diseases that we're talking about, hypertension, diabetes, other immune-mediated diseases. Although I suppose it's sacrilege, I think that the $1,000 genome will not actually have great clinical utility until we begin integrating that information with many of these other much more complicated data sets. I'm not sure exactly what a clinician will do if they find out that they have a PTPN22 SNP that's associated with RA. That in and of itself is not going to be particularly clinically useful, but it may be when that is integrated with the epigenetic marks and some other environmental influences, and perhaps even the fecal microbiome, that we'll be able to do much more in terms of predictive modeling. What will ultimately be needed are not only multiple technologies, but very deep patient phenotyping to begin to dissect it. It's not just does somebody have RA or lupus or diabetes, but when did they get it? What exactly is their phenotype that distinguishes them from somebody else that has RA, that has that disease, and then begin to correlate many of these omics databases with the deep clinical phenotype. And then my prediction, unfortunately, is that there will be slow incremental success, but we will eventually get there. So the data that we have right now doesn't actually get us to the finish line. What it does is it gets us closer to the starting line, so that we can now then begin to look at all of the multitude of influences that determine health and disease. Thank you very much.
Well, that was fantastic, a fantastic series of three talks. Can I now have all the speakers please come up and sit in these chairs? It looks like a little bit like the Inquisition. And I've gotten a series of questions here. So this one was for all of them, but I think for all speakers, but I think what I'm going to do so that we can get on to several is I'm first going to have Eric address it and then followed by Gary, and then I'll come up with a cancer-specific question next. So is there an advantage for people to get their DNA sequenced now?
I completely agree with what we heard the previous speaker say, that the here and now associated with genome sequence are for limited applications, of which I think cancer and rare disease. And I think that's completely consistent with what I also said. I would almost leave it at that. I think for many applications right now, these are purely down the road, and it would not, I just don't see the value at the moment. Do you want to add to that?
I completely agree with myself. No, I right. I mean, I think in the end, it's not just the DNA sequence, but some of these other platforms that are going to be needed ultimately to be able to stratify patients into risk for disease and also hopefully stratify them into potential responses to individualized therapy.
I mainly agree with the other speakers. I think that definitely cancer patients should be sequenced. I think that another place, which might be implied by rare tumors, is or by cancer, is people who have cancer in their family, excessive numbers of cancers in their family, might be another place where sequencing can sometimes be useful. But the general population, it's probably confusing and not that useful.
Okay, let's just have you keep the microphone, and this one was directed towards Dr. Green, but I think having everyone talk is good. Who should own a person's sequence? Is this something that should be put into the public domain? Should insurance companies have access to it? What do you think should happen once an individual decides to get sequenced, either for the fun of it or for a potential therapeutic intervention?
Well, I think it's a very deep question, actually. I think the person should own their sequence, obviously, or at least that's obvious to me. One of the things that I find amusing, actually, is that we talk about sequencing our patients and having access to their entire medical chart, but we won't know their name, so we have their privacy. And I think that's a little bit contradictory. If you know a person's entire sequence and their entire medical chart, you actually know who they are pretty well. But at any rate, yeah, I think a person should own their own sequence.
I mean, it's a great question and quite relevant. So the answer today is that it depends. If the sequence is generated as part of clinical care, they clearly own their own information. But there are actually NIH requirements that if you perform sequencing, that you have to actually deposit that information into public databases so that others can potentially use it. So the question then is whether those are truly de-identified or not. So one school of thought is that if you know someone's DNA sequence, you know who they are. I'm frankly more concerned about my Social Security number being stolen than my DNA sequence, but I do think in 10 years, 20 years, that risk will be actually quite significant.
But to be clear, the obligations to deposit data of human genome sequence data into databases were for individuals who consented to have that done. So it's not that you were forced and somehow we force somebody to give their DNA and then have it be deposited. This is part of situations where people consented to it. The other part, I mean, I of course agree people should have control of their own sequence. The other part of your question, Kelly, related though to sort of hinted at the incredible value of having data available. And related to what we were just talking about,
you know, what I would love to see happen more, and we are certainly working on this a lot, is getting people engaged in research and participating more in research, because what we need to do is have a public who is willing to participate and to have their data, their medical data, but also their genomic data, taking proper care of it, but then have it available for scientists to analyze. Because the kinds of studies we need, certainly for common diseases that you talked about and I talked about, are participation of not just thousands of individuals, but tens of thousands of individuals. And we need tens of thousands of individuals to step forward, be willing. They have to trust us, and we need to make sure we preserve their trust that we're going to take care of that data. But to make that available for scientists to be able to pore over, analyze, and figure out the genomic basis of these complicated disorders.
So there's another component to this question, and that is, what is patentable? So if somebody comes in and they have their genome sequenced as part of a clinical trial, what parts of that information can be taken and be patented?
Well, the Supreme Court ruled, literally the day our Smithsonian's exhibition opened, ironically, that after a long legal battle, that inherently DNA is not patentable in its native form. There's patentability if you do things with DNA and enhance the value of it through manipulations. But fundamentally, raw genomic information is not patentable. That's the current state of the law.
Okay. And so this is another question, and it is, who is deciding what genomic targets should be studied first and who should have a role? So let's think of this as, there's many diseases that have a genomic component to them. Who's deciding what diseases get to be analyzed first? Who's going to benefit from all of this?
You want me to take a pass at that? I was hoping I wouldn't have to do it first. Put it in a broader context. The broader context is decisions are made about resources that are put into disease studies, whether those resources are deployed for genomic studies of cancer or whether it's deployed for therapeutic studies of cancer or whether it's for any of hypertension. Decisions are made by the federal government all the time of how to use taxpayer dollars to dole across the different disease areas. So I think, and then on top of that, of course, we have the private sector, whether it be private foundations who are raising money or whether it be pharmaceutical companies or other aspects of the private sector making decisions. I mean, all these forces there's a very complicated ecosystem at play here where there's many decision makers about putting resources in. And that's going to follow whether it's genomic studies of cancer or whether it's other types of studies of cancer or any other disease process. Do you want to add to that? Universities are making this decision.
A couple of the decision makers sitting
right,
here.
Right. I mean, universities are making decisions where they're putting resources into certain disease areas.
Yeah, and I would say that a lot of it is driven by individual investigator decisions who look at funding sources, their own scientific interests, what they feel are pressing needs. And there are enough scientists out there that you pretty much cover the gamut, I think, based on just sheer numbers. It's not equally distributed, but it's driven by a variety of influences.
I think maybe a little bit different decision making by the federal government versus private investors, and a lot of what happens in universities is driven actually by the federal government, what grants are available. But I think private investors and companies are driven by the marketability and how they perceive the profitability of certain initiatives. So different ways of looking at it.
Okay, that's fantastic. That's the end of our Q&A session here. So let's give our speakers a round of applause for this very exciting and stimulating conference. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.